I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Most parents are familiar with a three-word refrain, "My tummy hurts." Some are likely to dismiss it as the complaint of an overzealous little eater, but the holidays are upon us, and for many that means those meals will be larger. Today, we talk with a gastroenterologist and a pediatrician to learn when the gripes can be handled with reassuring words and when they might mean something more serious is at hand. We'll also discuss how to introduce youngsters to new foods and what to do when your child eats a non-food item like a coin or a pebble, and then what to give them to eat and drink afterward. Plus, the band of the week in our local listen will get you up to date after this hour's news. It's getting to be that most wonderful time of the year for food and family of all shapes and sizes. But one thing that's certain, when you've got everyone around that table, eating too much, eating foods of uncertain provenance and of uncertain food preparation practices, eating, one thing that's certain is that someone, most especially the little ones, might feel sick. Today, as part of our Children's Health series, we're talking about when your kid's tummy hurts, not just at the holidays either. Joining us is our regular guide, Dr. Natasha Burgert. She's a pediatrician with the Pediatric Associates of Kansas City. Hi, Natasha.
Great to be here, Brian.
Good to have you back. And also joining us today is Dr. Craig Friesen. He's Division Director of Pediatric Gastroenterology at Children's Mercy Hospital. And Craig, does that mean you're in charge of tummy troubles?
Sort of. It's like herding sheep anyway, in some way. But yes, good morning.
Good morning. We're glad you're here. I'm curious if you, as physicians, see more patients with stomach aches around the holidays, or is this pretty much the same year-round?
For me, I certainly see some seasonal variability with this complaint. And the holidays with the different foods that you might have mentioned, and certainly with the different stresses that come with the holidays as well, is ample time for tummy troubles to begin.
That true for you too, Craig?
No, we don't really see people at the holidays. I think most of those get handled by their pediatricians and don't ever make it to us. So our seasonal variation is going to be when school starts. We tend to get a big rush of kids.
I see. That's interesting. Well, I want to invite our listeners to this conversation very early. We want to hear your questions for our pediatric specialists. We're focusing today on problems of the gastrointestinal and digestive variety. So if you have questions or maybe a story to share, give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also reach us on Twitter. We're at KCURUpToDate. Again, the number is 235-2888. So let me start with this. Dr. Burgert, when we talk about tummy troubles, all the things that could make a child say, "My tummy hurts," we could mean a bunch of different things, right? Give us a sense of the range of options.
Well, I think what most parents are really worried about when their kid says that their tummy hurts is that they're going to ignore the complaint and there's really going to be something wrong. And so that's when they come into our office, especially if the complaint is persistent. But there's a lot of things that can make a kid's tummy hurt. And from my seat, seeing these kids very frequently through, it's either poop or stress, or stress or poop. That's 90% of what we do.
Well, we were taking bets on when the first mention of poop would occur during the show. So there we are.
Okay, you can pay me later.
Yeah.
But of course, there are some other significant problems with the gut that we certainly don't want to miss. And that's what we tease out when parents come in to see me first, and whether or not we need to see Dr. Friesen and with his specialist help.
And there are a lot of things that we call a stomach ache that aren't really happening in our stomachs at all, right? Mm-hmm. What's the range of what parts of the body are we talking about here?
Well, I think it's really hard, especially for the littlest set, to kind of define what a tummy ache is. And I think there are some kids that understand there's something wrong with their body or they're not feeling well. And that's kind of the default. I'm going to grab my, tummy. It's right here. I just don't feel good. So it takes some astute parenting, some good focused questions, and sometimes a trip to the doctor to really figure out what part the kids are talking about.
Dr. Friesen, obviously, by the time the kid goes to Children's Mercy, you're talking about more serious problems, or at least potential problems. What are some of the most common of those more serious problems kids have in their tummy?
Well, when we're talking about chronic pain, there's a number of diseases that you can only find with the scope. So that's, for the most part, the reason they're going to send them to us. But the lifelong things, celiac disease, people with ulcer disease, particularly if it's related to bacteria, people with inflammatory bowel disease, which is a lifelong condition where your stomach's really going to look like you have the stomach flu continuously or periodically. But there are a number of diseases, gallbladder, pancreas, all the rest of those are rare.
I guess I'm curious, Dr. Burgert, is there such a thing as a normal stomach ache, just the average run-of-the-mill stomach ache? And what exactly is that?
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, we all don't have best days. And in my practice, when I'm talking to parents, you know, kids that may not be 100% that day, you've got kids that are going to complain of headaches, or you got kids that are going to complain of tummy aches. And I think that for some kids, just complaining of those tummy troubles is just that something in that homeostasis of our bodies is just not quite right. And that's the only way that they can communicate it. We have a lot of hormone sensors in our gut. And so if we have an ache or pain,
Say more about that. What do you mean a hormone sensor?
So our guts is an immune system, and our gut helps us digest food, and our gut really responds to our emotions just with all of the different hormones that flood our bodies for all sorts of different reasons. And so if we have a particularly emotional day, for example, of course we can see that physically on the outside with certain emotions, but we have to remember that affects our gut too and our different organ systems. And so sometimes the tummy troubles are simply a cue that something else is going on, or that there's another body part that needs attention to. Again, coming back with the persistence and the questions and kind of getting some more clues.
And how often would you say is it more serious than just something you ate that's going to pass, that's going to need more attention?
And that's a great question. I'm going to say 90% of the time it's poop or stress or poop, 90%. Mm-hmm. And the other 10%, I'm turning to Dr. Friesen and I'm asking for help, because we have to look on the inside, just like he said.
Yeah. I guess the hard thing for me, and I have said I'm not a parent, but I guess if I were a parent, the hard part would be, how do you know when it's not the 10%? And what keeps you from just being a parent who says, I'm going to take the kid to the doctor in the emergency room because I just can't be sure?
No, absolutely. And I think that there are some clues that we can use. First, kids that are going to have some serious issues, and I'd love to hear Dr. Friesen's list as well. But some of the things that I listen for in the parent story is weight loss, growth problems, persistent vomiting, feeding refusal, blood in the poop. You know, some things that are otherwise going to be alarming, weird rashes, kids are fatigued. Like, there's something else besides the tummy trouble. And we can't ignore the fact, too, that common things like pneumonia and strep throat and urinary tract infections, they can also present as tummy ache, too. So sometimes it's just some initial evaluation to kind of rule some things out before we kind of figure out, is this really a tummy issue that we need to persist?
And you listed off quite a list of things, some of which I gather might happen to kids with some regularity. So is it when you have a combination of those things, it's the weight loss and the blood in the feces?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's going to be a combination. It's going to be a spectrum. I really trust those parents that come in and say something's just not right. You have that little bit of intuition. And I think it's also an appropriate reason to come to the doctor if you're seeing that constellation of symptoms, just so that you can get the okay, too, to make sure that, this is just something else we can manage at home.
We're talking about children's health today, and particularly about the digestive system and tummy troubles. Dr. Natasha Burgert is here. She's a pediatrician with the Pediatric Associates of Kansas City, our regular guide to children's health around here. And Dr. Craig Friesen of Children's Mercy Hospital is here, too. Join our conversation at 816-235-2888 with your questions or your stories about children's health, and specifically about the things that they eat and the impact that has on them. Dr. Friesen, when a child does come to you, you mentioned that some things can only be figured out with a scope. Walk us through the typical visit to your office the kid has been referred there.
Sure. You know, part of this is all the pre-referral stuff. So I'm going to put a little plug in. Pediatricians have a much harder, job than I have.
The first line of defense.
Yeah, because I don't have to worry about things outside of the stomach and intestines. That all gets screened. They sort it out. And
you know there's a problem by the time it comes to you.
Yeah, someone has already sorted that out, and we know, okay, there's something else going on. And, I tell you, in our house, our approach was go poop, and if you're not better, go play. And if they did that, I didn't worry about them. And so I think there's a pretty quick screening. But I think when it starts interfering with activity, to me, that means you need to go see somebody. For us, what we're going to do initially really depends on how much of those red flag symptoms that could indicate a more significant disease. And my list is very similar to Dr. Burgert's, you know, but for us, it's going to be weight loss, blood coming out from either end, you know, excessive vomiting, excessive diarrhea. And we also throw in if your pain's on the low right side or the upper right side and it just localized there, that's not typical. So those are things they're going to say to us, it's probably time to do tests.
Upper right side, which would indicate?
Well, it can be gallbladder disease, mm-hmm. liver-related disease. And so we're going to do some testing to sort that out, you know, particularly if they have some other symptoms like vomiting and those kinds of things that would make us think there may be something more significant going on. Typically, saying that you don't have those symptoms, we're going to see them, look at the kind of symptom constellation they have, and try some medications because certain symptoms will predict that certain medicines are going to fix your problem. And so we will do those medications and then, you know, usually give the kids a couple weeks. If it doesn't work, then it's going to be time that we're going to go do tests.
Yeah, I'm curious, Dr. Burgert, we just heard Dr. Friesen say excessive vomiting, excessive diarrhea. Those things are part of a lot of kids' lives at various points, and it doesn't require a trip to the doctor. What does excessive mean?
No, and that's going to be different for every kid and kind of different for the age. But I think most families, you know, for my families, it's really the rule of threes. Like, if it's more than 3 days, like, that's something that you at least need to call us about to kind of get a little bit more details, whether that's either end of the spectrum, either mm-hmm. end it's coming out of. So, mm-hmm. And again, associated with concerns about eating, dehydration, that kind of stuff.
We've been talking about things you can do with kids who are verbal or who are old enough to go poop when you tell them or go out and play. What about kids who are too young to express these pains specifically?
No, that's a great question, and a lot of parents come in with babies. They're concerned about babies or concerned about when they start solid foods, like some GI disruption that they may have. And for most kids, we lean heavily on that growth chart. Kids that have chronic disease or chronic gut problems aren't going to grow right. And so it does matter that every child comes in for routine visits so that we can get a good pattern of their growth to make sure that if something is going wrong, we get that as a clue. And again, it comes back to that constellation of symptoms. It's not just going to be irritable belly. We're going to see rashes. We're going to see prolonged vomiting. We're going to see
rashes
blood
on all over
can
their
be
body?
Anywhere. Could okay. be anywhere. I mean, it's the skin gives us a huge clue of lots of different things that can be happening with a kid, especially one that's pre-verbal. So there's very characteristic patterns, not only for GI conditions, but also other conditions that can make kids irritable as well. So the skin is a huge clue.
Let's actually take a question. We've got one from Taylor. She called 816-235-2888, and you can too with your questions. 235-2888. Taylor from Kansas City. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering. I have. I'm not a parent, but I'm curious if the benefits of fasting, like small fasts that are every day, like when you sleep, 12-hour fast, can benefit children's like gastrointestinal health as well. It can for adults.
Good question, Taylor. Thank you. Dr. Friesen, is there any benefit to children from short fasts from eating?
I think that it's probably unlikely. There really are no studies that have looked at what happens with fasting. And in fact, even what you take in, there are very few studies to say.
Are you speaking of adults or just
children? Talking about children.
Okay, just children.
Yeah. And so, you know, those are hard studies to do because most people are not going to view that as an ethical study to do in a child to say we're going to fast them. And in mm-hmm. fact, you know, studies we do where we need them to fast for a certain period of time, do a test, people certainly take issue with the discomfort it puts kids through.
I can't go without feeding my child.
Yeah, and, you know, to be honest, there are very few studies that have actually looked at what you can do diet-wise and does it make a difference. And so, you know, so the answer is I don't have an honest answer to say we know scientifically.
Let me ask a very basic question. Can we talk about kind of the run-of-the-mill stomach ache? You eat something that maybe you shouldn't have eaten, or you eat too much of it, or you picked up a bug at school or whatever. What is happening medically there? Why does that make a child's tummy hurt?
Well, it depends on assuming that what you're alluding to is either a virus or a bacteria kind of gets into your system.
Yeah.
And it changes that bacteria likes to attack the stomach lining. It likes to attack kind of the GI skin itself. And so that makes it really irritated. So a natural response to the body is, let's get rid of it. Let's mm-hmm. get it out. And so really it's the vomiting and diarrhea, as disgusting and kind of annoying as it is, can be protective. It's their body's trying to protect us from that insult and to get rid of that pathogen to keep us healthy.
We had a show earlier this week on Central Standard about food safety around this time of year. How often do you think stomach aches or other tummy troubles are caused by things that would be preventable if people did a better job of washing their hands or not eating food that's been sitting out too long?
Definitely washing hands is a big one with kids, for sure. Plus, they're also putting stuff in their mouths all the time. So a lot of that stuff is kind of hard to prevent. Most of the time for ingestions, we get it in travel. Like, we get travel stories. I think people are particularly naturally vigilant with their kids and what they let them consume. I think us as adults get a little bit more willing to eat the questionable potato salad, you know, but really it's travel and that lack of control when your kids are on a plane or in a foreign space to consume things that they shouldn't. That at the end of the day, the results are the same. You've got the runs.
Let's talk to Gayla in Prairie Village. Hi, Gayla.
So I'm actually a nurse at Children's Mercy, and it's something that I see every once in a while. And so I had a quick question for both of your experts there. I've noted that sometimes those tummy ache complaints that we have coming in, we end up kind of linking them more to mental health issues, anxiety, depression, things like that. And I'm wondering, as professionals, how do you help tease out the psychosomatic issues where it's really it's more an emotional issue than a physical one?
Great question. Thanks for your call, Gayla. Dr. Friesen, is a tummy problem a sign of stress?
Well, absolutely. Anything that's going on in your gut gets worse with stress. We know every disease where it's been studied gets worse. Diabetics run higher blood sugars, asthmatics wheeze more, and if you have a reason to have abdominal pain, stress makes it worse. And the pathway is well mapped. You know, the gut, we talked about nerves before, but there are as many nerve cells in the gut as there are in your brain and your spinal cord combined.
So how do you tease that out, which is Gayla's question? How do you know that that's what it is?
Well, I run the abdominal pain clinic or co-manage that, and you know, our visits are always a psychologist and me together. Mm-hmm. So we recognize it as part of every medical condition, and in fact, our belief is that we should be looking at that for regardless of diseases, whether we consider them organic or not. And so we just make the assumption it is, but we will do screening for it as a part. We know the brain and the gut are well connected, and if you have something going on, but you know, the question we always ask is, why does this child with stress get abdominal pain? Because most don't. Some get headaches, some get back pain. So what is it unique about this child? Because there virtually always is a biological component to that. So how does stress move into the gut? And so we're also looking for what are the stress-related gut conditions that we can intervene with from medication while we're working on the other aspects of this.
And so it's not an either-or. It's often a both-and.
I think it's – we have no way to sort out. Is this 5% psychological? Is this 95%? I think you just make the assumption, okay, are there targets there that we can intervene in that's going to help this child now and prevent this from coming back in the future, and you just go after it.
I think it's challenging, too, because it's a vicious cycle, right? Like, when you get belly pain, that stresses kids out, and they get nervous that they're sick and there's something wrong, which – makes the belly hurt worse, and it's a very real experience. It's a very real pain, and so it's working together, from my perspective, for the entire family to try and look for those clues, look for those stress points, look for the patterns of pain, be able to try and offer comfort measures when they are, and then meanwhile we are looking still for the red flag symptoms that Dr. Friesen alluded to make sure we're not missing something. So a lot of times this is not like a 20-minute visit in the office and we get an answer. This is a little bit of history. It's a little bit of time in order to tease that out.
Well, and I would think that would be especially hard if the child is not able to speak.
Absolutely.
If we're at a younger age.
Well, and ultimately, whether we identify a disease or we can't, so what we call functional GI disorders, where we can't put a name to it, this isn't Crohn's disease, it's not celiac, it's not an ulcer, if you look at that sort of negative life event, stresses in your life, if you go in and measure stress, anxiety, depression, those kinds of things, they have the same score, whether you have an identifiable disease or not. So it becomes sort of a false dichotomy to say, oh, we can't find a disease, therefore it's now it's psychological, let's intervene there, and certainly not a positive message to parents or one that's very helpful in terms of helping that child get better.
You've mentioned those diseases a couple of times. Irritable or inflammatory bowel disease, you've mentioned celiac. These are diseases we talk about with adults quite often. How are they different when the onset of those diseases occurs for children, Dr. Friesen?
Well, the symptoms tend to vary by age. So, you know, we see a lot of the same diseases, but with different frequency. A lot of these are more common in adults. And to get back to what Dr. Burgert said before, it really is about 10% of kids, even that get referred, are going to identify those conditions. So most of them are going to fit in other categories, but they tend to present with different symptoms, which is the challenge. So if you're a 10-year-old and you get an ulcer, you're going to have typical adult symptoms. If you're a 3-year-old and get an ulcer, you're just going to throw up. You're not going to have pain. And so you got to be aware of, okay, at any given age, what symptoms may indicate that there's something going on.
Let's take a little break. When we come back, we will hear from a few more listeners who are on the line. You can join them in talking with Dr. Natasha Burgert and Dr. Craig Friesen by calling 816-235-2888. We'll continue this discussion about the gastrointestinal health of kids. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we learned about cross-dressing on the American frontier. We also talked with a psychiatrist about arguments that connect mental health to gun violence. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, Up to Date will be off, but KCUR will present the Splendid Tables Turkey Confidential 2017. It's 2 hours of live conversation and calls on preparing, troubleshooting, and saving your holiday meal. You can gobble that up starting at 11 a.m. Yep, that's what I said. Up to Date will return on Monday, the 27th. Coming up later, we've got our local listen, but first, we continue this conversation about the trials and tribulations of a child's gastrointestinal tract, especially at this time of year. We're talking with Dr. Natasha Burgert, a pediatrician with the Pediatric Associates of Kansas City, and also Dr. Craig Friesen with Children's Mercy Hospital. We're also talking with you. Call us at 816-235-2888 with your questions. Let's talk to Madison in Overland Park. Hi, Madison.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Doing great.
So my question is, how can I better coach parents and give them some tips on how to get their children to eat a wider variety of fruits and vegetables, getting enough fiber, since that's one of the most important things for gut health?
Good question, Madison. And Madison raises kind of the bigger question of diet and how that affects kids' tummies. Let's start with that and then zero in on Madison's question. Dr. Burgert, what should kids be eating and drinking to help in this area?
Well, I completely agree with Madison that we need to have a really dynamic, varied diet of whole natural foods in order to have not only gut health, but immune health and general body wellness. It's really hard to micromanage another human being, however, right? And so if the toddler really is going to put their foot down and say, I'm not going to eat anything that's not orange, you know, you have to pick your battles. But that being said, I think we also we have opportunities to encourage that. And kind of to answer Madison's questions, one of the biggest things that I recommend to my families, and certainly what evidence would suggest as well, is if we want our kids to stay well hydrated and if we want them to eat well and have them have whole natural foods, that's what we as parents need to be enthusiastic about. We need to eat more of it than they do, and we need to show them how awesome it is. Show them that they're going to miss out if they don't get these veggies on their plate without being punitive, without making assumptions. But it really comes back to us. Our kids' eating habits, for the most part, are a reflection of what we eat.
This seems like an easier said than done situation, getting your kids to eat. If it involves changing what you eat, that could be a real challenge. Dr. Friesen, I'm curious, when we're speaking of what we eat and drink, a lot of parents wonder when the kid feels sick, maybe after they've thrown up or had the diarrhea, what's the best thing to be giving them then in terms of food and drink to rehydrate themselves or to settle their stomach, as we sometimes say?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the plain old bland diets that people have talked about for probably 200 years
it's
are the best.
True.
You know, what kids are going to be sensitive to are spices because they actually directly stimulate nerves in there. They're going to be more sensitive to fat because anytime you have any inflammation, it increases fat sensitivity. We would want them off carbonation. We wouldn't want them to get any caffeine. So, you know, the time-tested are probably the best recommendations in that acute moment.
Okay, so the soda crackers are good, but the ginger ale or the 7-Up that I was sometimes given as a child, that was not good, it sounds like.
Not always the best. I always kind of advise parents to parents really freak out. They don't want their kids to get dehydrated, understandably so for many reasons. But especially after a kid throws up, like if you try to feed them right away, they're going to throw up again. And so you kind of have to chill just a little bit. You know, get the crackers, get the Gatorade off the shelf. But I usually recommend waiting a good 15, 20 minutes before you start really pushing fluids and pushing food, just because within that 20-minute window, you're likely going to see it again.
Yeah, and you mentioned ginger ale, which oftentimes doesn't have much ginger in it, but there actually is some utility to ginger in this. And we actually use it very frequently for chronic nausea. Ginger breakdown products actually improve stomach emptying. And part of that aftermath of the flu has to do with poor emptying. So there are certainly studies that have shown to be effective for motion sickness better than prescription drugs. So since you mentioned ginger, put a plug in for it. It's something that folks can do on their own if kids are nauseated or vomiting. Once they are keeping something down, which really has no side effects.
That's great. 816-235-2888. 235-2888 is the number to call with your questions for Dr. Craig Friesen and Dr. Natasha Burgard. Marty from Kansas City is here with us. Hi, Marty. Marty, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am.
Okay. If you're on speakerphone, Marty, that's not going to work. So if you can...
Now I'm not.
Okay, go ahead. What's your question?
My question is, I'm concerned about the agricultural chemicals that the kids ingest with the, you know, the normal diet that you eat. And what that does, I've read some stuff about what that does to the flora in the stomach, in the intestine, that it might break down the defenses to childhood diseases. And if they would like to comment on that, I'd really appreciate it.
Appreciate that, Marty. Is this a hot topic in the medical world, Dr. Friesen?
Well, the microbes or bacteria in the intestines are absolutely a hot topic, and it's known it doesn't just affect gut health, but heart health has a lot of. There's a lot of brain effects, links with a number of conditions, anxiety, depression, even with dyslexia, in terms of worsening some symptoms. But, you know, in terms of the chemicals, I can't speak directly to that, but we know diet in general actually has a huge impact on what's going to happen to your microbes. And, you know, when it gets back to it, a healthy diet tends to promote the right number of microbes. Certainly antibiotic exposure in animals and frankly, over-treatment sometimes in humans is a problem. You know, ultimately, I think it's going to be really important for all GI diseases, but frankly, pain without a known disease.
Is there disagreement in the medical community over the nature of this problem, or is this a consensus?
I think there's an absolute consensus that it's an important player that affects diseases. You know, the average person has 7,000 to 10,000 species of bacteria. So getting into the what's the right mix, how do you appropriately manipulate that in a way that's going to be positive from a health standpoint, certainly that remains controversial and unproven.
We had a question. We talked a little bit earlier about dietary suggestions we would make for parents. I have a question from Caperton on Facebook who asks, says that she's been thinking about lactose intolerance and Lactaid tablets. Is it better for a child to just not eat or drink dairy, or is it okay or good for them to take a supplement that helps them digest it?
That's a great question. Usually when we're talking about true lactose intolerance, we're talking about older kids, although some kids can be sensitive to those milk proteins in which those lactate type stuff might not work. You know, dairy is a huge component of a kid's life. Usually, they're usually a lot of milk and cheese and yogurt eaters, and it's a good fat, has good protein, and certainly a great source of calcium for those growing bodies. So before I manipulate the dairy, I really want to know what we're dealing with, and sometimes that is a strict elimination diet just to make sure that we're headed down the right track before we start with alternative milks and lactate tablets and kind of eliminating what most kids can tolerate on their diet quite well. So that's looking at your diet, taking it away for a couple of weeks, and then on day 15, you know, binging on it and seeing what happens. And the most of the time in the interim, what parents find is it may not be that particular dairy, it's something else in their diet, or it's just been a couple of bad weeks, which is certainly allowed as well.
Are there particular substitutes for dairy that you recommend for parents?
Not particularly. We want good fat. We want good protein. We want good calcium. So when we're talking about alternative milks and all of this kind of stuff, most of those are just supplemented in some sort and have a lot of variability in their quality and usually have a lot of sugar. So I try to think of other whole natural sources for them to replace that dairy. To replace the fat and protein, maybe a calcium supplement. But if a kid's truly dairy intolerant, usually they're getting the other nutrients from the other parts of their food, unless you disagree, Dr. Friesen, and
I agree too. But, you know, kids who are, if it's purely lactose intolerance, and by the way, lactose intolerance is diagnosed 10 times more often than it actually exists.
It's one of those things, yeah.
But if you actually know that's what it is, those kids typically will tolerate yogurt and hard cheeses. So you do have some dairy sources that you can use because the bacteria digesting yogurt and hard cheese has relatively little lactose.
As long as I can still have cheese, I don't mind being lactose intolerant. That's great.
Just not pizza cheese.
Okay, fair enough. 816-235-2888 is the number to call if you have questions for Dr. Craig Friesen and Dr. Natasha Burgert. 235-2888. Don't forget, we're also on Twitter. You can ask questions there at KCUR. Up to date. From that lovely conversation about food, let's talk a little more about poop. You've already indicated that that's one of the things to watch for as a sign of a more serious gastrointestinal problem with kids. You mentioned blood, which I think would stand out to most parents as an mm-hmm. obvious problem. Are there other things maybe less obvious that parents should be aware of and paying attention to?
Well, I think constipation is a big issue in our society kind of in general, probably because of our diets, probably because of not as much hydration as our kids probably should be drinking. However, I think it becomes really insidious because as kids get older, they get more independence in the bathroom and you can't ask a parent of a 9-year-old when your kid pooped last. They're not going to know the answer versus a parent of a newborn who has it on an app and can tell you to the minute. Mm-hmm. So, what happens over time, I think, is these kids, they develop some backup and they start to have belly pain after they eat or other things and other symptoms. And so parents will automatically defer to this must be a food allergy or it must be celiac disease, or they kind of go in different directions when most often they do need to go just to the bathroom. So we talk a lot about fiber gummies and probiotics and adding some stool softeners and that kind of stuff when kids come in with belly pain, just to make sure that they're going as much as we think that they're going before we really do a lot of invasive testing or something like that first. Because again, it's either poop or stress or poop. We got to make sure it's not the poop.
We had a question from Katie on Facebook, and by the number of exclamation points and question marks in this, I suspect this is from experience. Chronic constipation in toddlers, will they outgrow it? Will they?
That's really up in the air. You know, for the first 20 years I was in practice, we told everybody, if you just do these things, you're going to outgrow it. There are enough long-term follow-up studies to say that probably for 40%, it continues to be a problem to some degree in their life. But certainly in the toddler years, if you get out ahead of it, you're going to have a milder course, even if you have persistent symptoms.
So be encouraged.
Yeah, be encouraged. And especially in the toddler set, a lot of them need to have stool softeners. They need to have some sort of supplements in order to be able to go. And I know in my practice, Dr. Friesen, a lot of people have been increasingly concerned recently about Miralax. And I would love to hear your comments on using that as a supplement for toddlers and young children as far as its safety profile.
Remind us what Miralax is.
Miralax is, the way to think about it, is basically a salt that you can't absorb. So it continues to keep fluid within your bowels. And there's certainly been some controversies and things in lay press regarding this. You know, there has been actually a panel of experts that have looked at it and have issued a statement that they believe this is the safest long-term treatment for constipation in kids. It really has no proven side effects, and basically all it is, you know, something that keeps extra water in the stool. So if you give a lot of it, you can keep a lot of water in there and flush them out. If you give a little bit, it's a stool softener. But it really is, for people who do what I do, the treatment of choice, because it's the easiest to sort of adjust to keep kids' pattern where you need for them to do well in the long run.
Getting a thumbs up from Dr. Bergert on that.
Good.
You know, we've mentioned that part of why we're doing this show at this time is because the holidays are coming up, and we touched on the beginning of the show, the fact that people eat more and maybe some foods that are unfamiliar. Do you think there's anything about the way we celebrate the holidays in this country, the array of foods that we eat, that puts kids especially at risk for tummy troubles? And with that in mind, are there things that you would encourage parents to have kids stay away from?
You know, I don't want to be the Debbie Downer of Thanksgiving.
It's your job.
But, I know. when Thanksgiving and our own traditions through the holidays are so formative in our childhood years. So is it going to give them a tummy ache if grandpa, pulls out a big bag of candy and just lets them go nuts? Yeah, most likely. But is that what grandpas do? Absolutely. So I'm not going, we know what the consequences to some of that. But I think what's most important, Brian, to discuss around the holidays is kids that are not so much getting into foods that they may otherwise not have, but really getting into products, ingestions, holiday toys, batteries, other things that kids put into their mouths during the holiday season, that really is a medical issue. I think we should talk about that a bit.
Well, then let's talk about it. Children should or should not eat batteries?
Children should not eat
batteries. Thank you.
Only high fiber batteries.
Right. I mean, I think it's about the quality of the battery, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But batteries are particularly dangerous, especially because a lot of times it's not witnessed. They've been swallowed. We just find a toddler with an empty package or a toy and batteries missing around them. But batteries themselves can cause ulcerations, really significant internal damage. That's something that we just need to be mindful of as we're going through the holiday season. But we also have to be mindful of our pretty glittery holiday ornaments that these kids want to put in their mouths, holiday ornaments that look like candy or look like food that they ingest. And just be mindful as we're traveling to all of our families' houses that they may not be as vigorous or as vigilant with their childproofing as you may be. And we just have to be mindful to watch our kids in those environments. I would also recommend that every parent, before you travel, put the poison control number in their phone. It's 1-800-222-1222.
So that is not the number to call with questions.
No, that's not to call with questions. That is the poison control number. But I always believe in Murphy's Law, that if you have the poison control numbers in your iPhone, you'll never have to use it. So as you're traveling through the season, it's an important number to have.
1-800-222-1222. But let's say that it does happen. You discover that your child has swallowed a penny or a small Christmas ornament or something that is not, they're not choking, but you wonder what's happening now. Do you panic or do you wait and see? What do you recommend? Go ahead, Dr. Berger.
You can't, for if you think it's a battery, it's not a wait and see situation. You've got to know to make sure that battery's not in there, and so you're going to the ER to get an x-ray. That's a particularly dangerous one. Coins are really common. Coins you can easily choke on or easily aspirate, so you're looking for signs of choking, which would be vomiting, drooling, pain, grabbing the neck. They don't want to eat. Normal stuff you're going to be worried about.
How long are you waiting after the dime or penny might have been consumed?
Well, it's going to be fairly soon that they're going to start to show some symptoms if they're uncomfortable. And coins can be particularly tricky of where they like to land, either if they like to land in the windpipe or if they like to go down the esophagus. If a kid swallows a coin, for most intents and purposes, they're going to pass and it's going to be fine. We just want to make sure that it's not in the windpipe, and that's the symptoms that we're looking for too. But for other Legos, common. Sharp things like sometimes pins or the little things that hang the ornaments on the Christmas tree can be sharp. Most of those stuff are actually quite fine. Certainly you want to talk to your give a pediatrician a call, make sure that, but if the kid's otherwise doing fine, we don't really have to do about that kind of stuff. It's really in where I sit in my life, it's the batteries. That's what we talk about a lot. That's really the one that makes us move urgently.
Should they still come and check it out if it's a Lego or a penny?
Oh, if they're not symptomatic, I'm not going to do anything about it.
Okay.
So only if they're having problems.
Dr. Friesen, if they are having problems, is this where you and your department sometimes get called in?
Yeah, for sure, because we're the ones who are going to go take them out. And so the things that we're going to view as emergent are the batteries, most sharp objects, actually, and then magnets are the other big one that come up in toys. And because all three of those can have bad outcomes, put holes through the intestines, cause obstructions and those things. So if those happen, we want to go take them out. The other place, though, is if it gets stuck in the esophagus or food tube going down, we consider those things that have to come out emergently because they will create a different set of problems. So, you know, the child swallows the coin. Most of us are going to give them 6 weeks to pass it. We're not going to do anything. So as long as the kids are able to eat and drink, because they will, 98% will eventually pass and we don't have to do anything. And they have almost no risk of creating any problems. So, you know, my personal rule is I say, if you don't see it, get another x-ray in 6 weeks. If it's there, we'll go take it. But I will tell you, even with that rule, half the time, by the time we go down there, it's passed somewhere between that x-ray and when we go look.
You just didn't know. 6 weeks. Seems like you should get interest or something. Yeah. So I, as we approach the holidays, I guess I'm also curious if there are other safety issues or other child development issues that you want parents to be thinking about, maybe as they start their holiday shopping. Are there words of guidance or suggestion, things to stay away from, or ways that you would take encourage them to take a look?
That's a great question. So family traditions are so important in developing resiliency. So we love this holiday season to be able to spend time with families, especially for young kids. And traveling can be just a huge stress for families. So making sure that we're keeping the bedtimes as routine as we can be and the mealtimes as routine as we can be, kind of to help those transitions, especially if you're traveling to places where the time zones change, that can be particularly disruptive. And then as we're thinking we're also, you know, Black Friday's coming up. We're thinking about our toy lists. We're thinking about the things that we want to buy. I'm particularly compassionate about limiting technology products to good quality products. CommonSenseMedia.org is going to be your place to go to look for quality video games or quality electronics for your kids. And I don't want to underestimate, like, the basics, like blocks and Legos and these non-tech things are still, there's amazing science kits for all ages to kids be creative and explore and really use their brains in addition to having a lot of fun.
Dr. Friesen, any final words of advice for parents as they approach the holiday season?
Be nice to your GI doc if you have one.
they're seeing a lot of challenging cases this time of year. I have to think. You know, one last question to kind of take us back to where we started. We talked about the child who comes to you and says, "My tummy hurts." If you're the parent who's trying to make the diagnosis of what to do in that moment, are there particular words? Are there particular questions that you would encourage them to ask? Places to point on their body, words to describe it that especially with smaller children who may just be learning to talk. What do you ask, Dr. Berger?
What I ask in the clinic is, can you point with one finger where it hurts? If they're pointing to their middle of the belly, then generally they're going to be okay. If you're thinking that they're pointing to someplace not in the middle of their belly, that just like Dr. Friesen alluded to, that's where we think about other things. And I love Dr. Friesen's comment, try to go poop and then try to go play, because I think that for kids that have significant issues, they are not going to be able to successfully do either.
Yeah, and on all levels, even referral, I think activity is it. If your child's not doing activities they should be doing, I think someone should check them out. You know, from our referral, it's kids who have gotten to the point where they don't go to school and aren't functioning at that level that we're going to intervene. So to me, it's functioning really tells you I need to be worried or I don't need to be worried. Kids who have a serious illness are not going to run around and play.
Mm-hmm. That's Dr. Craig Friesen. He's Division Director of Pediatric Gastroenterology at Children's Mercy Hospital. Also Dr. Natasha Burgert, our regular guide in these children's health shows, pediatrician with Pediatric Associates of Kansas City. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you both. It's Wednesday, which means KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you.
You have big Thanksgiving plans?
I sure do.
All right. Well, it'll be a mystery to us.
Well, I'm actually flying out of town, so I will not be able to attend this year's Thanksgiving Blues Breakfast Dance at the National Guard Armory in Kansas City, Kansas. But I've attended many of those functions. When I'm involved, it's a dangerous proposition because I'm a lightweight and doors open at 9 and the show starts at 10 at the BYOB event.
And the liquids are flowing even at that early hour.
And people tend to share. And so we could bring the doctor back in to tell us how to handle that.
I think we have some ideas. I assume you can still listen to some of the music by the artists who will be performing there, including the piece of music you've brought to us today.
That's right. There is a man who's based in Kansas City named T.J. Hooker Taylor, who was the son of the great soul and R&B legend Johnny Taylor. And I've chosen for us today a song called Your Babies Need a Daddy.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's take a listen.
Baby, you're looking so sexy, girl. It's not a mistake you have five kids without a father. A lot of men want to love on you. You just doing what you need to do. I'm not a fortune teller, but I have the gift to see when a woman needs love. I love a woman been through hard times in her life. I want you so badly, I can feel you next to me. I just bought me a new car. Come on, let me give you and your babies a ride home.
Your babies need a daddy.
Your babies need a daddy.
Is this for real, Bill?
Of course it's for real.
Okay.
You know, as you get older, relationships become more and more complicated. And TJ's, you know, definitely singing about a real life situation here.
Now TJ Hooker Taylor actually has some lineage in the blues world, right?
That's right. He was born here in Kansas City. Johnny Taylor had, his father had deep roots in Kansas City. And, you know, for those who don't remember, Johnny Taylor co-opted a 1963 hit by another artist named Little Johnny Taylor called Part-Time Love. He just made that song his own. And then he went on to have hits like Who's Making Love in 68 for Stax Records and Cheaper to Keep Her in 73. And then his big crossover hit in 1976, Disco Lady.
So his son here carrying on the tradition of, I guess you'd say, entertaining albums.
That's right. I mean, this is, you know, earthy, good time party music. And he'll be part of, you know, I'm sure he'll play this song tomorrow on Thursday morning at the Armory. But he'll be joined by another son of a blues legend. Muddy Waters Jr., a.k.a. Mud Morganfield, will headline the bill. That's the son of course, Muddy Waters.
So this is a BYOB event. You mentioned the doors open at 9. You said they'll hear this song, most likely. The concept of this song is, babies need a daddy, and he wants to be that guy.
Well, that's right. As he says at the top of the song, a lot of men, you know, want to love on you, and he's one of them, and he proposes that not only does he have a new car, but he's been saving money so he can buy the woman's five children, Christmas gifts. I think he's sincere and he has the best of intentions.
Well, it's a moving concept. I appreciate it. That's KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee with this week's Local Listen. You can find out more by attending the event, which is called what again, Bill?
It's called I just call it the Thanksgiving Morning Blues Breakfast Dance, and it's been going on for decades. Back in 1939, Cab Calloway was the headliner of such an event.
Wow, the National Guard Armory in KCK tomorrow morning. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Brian.
You can listen to our podcasts and our previous programs at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUptodate, and I'm at PTS Brian. Don't forget to also follow KCUR on Facebook. UpToDate will be off for the holiday tomorrow, but you'll still want to tune in for Turkey Confidential, 2 hours of live conversation and calls that could save your Thanksgiving meal. The legendary Bobby Watson composed our theme music, and we had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. Steve Kraske's back on Monday. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.